If you didn't grab a handout over there, and so the short of it is, I was able to, you know, kind of, as I've said, it's like putting a memorandum together. When I brought together all this information from all around the world, was able to put it into a book, and when I didn't know something, I got expert witnesses. So there's 15 co-authors who came in and were able to actually write the chapters in the book. The book is available in the bookstore. I brought two copies here that, in the bookstore, I think it's selling for 15. If you're here and you're part of this, it's $10 the next couple days. I can get more from the bookstore if you're in here. So I'll get them today and tomorrow. You can just, if you can pay cash here, you can do that. Cash is those little green things. They're like, kind of like that. Rolls of quarters will work too, whatever. So if you have a roll of quarter, that'd be really funny if you paid in that. But rather not have rolls of pennies. But if they're rolled, that's cool. I can take it to the bank. If you run a nonprofit, you take whatever you can get. That's another good lesson to learn from this talk. So yeah, the podcast is kind of the same to you. I kind of describe a podcast as a deposition that's actually interesting. So if you're a lawyer, you get that joke. Or if you've ever done a deposition, you get that joke. So anyhow, let's pray, and then we'll get started. And then people will probably trickle in as they're finishing their scones and donuts and coffee and whatever else, because it's been like an hour and a half since breakfast, so it's clear we need more food. Our Lord, I just thank you so much for today. Thank you for this group that's in here. As always, you bring exactly who's supposed to be in the room here so that we can learn more about how you love these children all around the world, how you love us, and how we can just use our gifts and talents to encourage and love others and to spur one another on to love and good deeds. Lord, help us to know how to do that. Help us to hear what we're supposed to hear today and everything else. Just if something's not coming from you, Lord, just let it fall on deaf ears. I just get excited to share your heart for these children, and I just pray that you'll help me to stay focused, and you'll help everyone out there to be able to really listen and be open to hearing some things that might be, some of the things might be tough to hear, and some of the things just may really confirm passions that we have, Lord. So I just pray for all that in your name, amen. All right, so let me start with a banana, exactly where you'd expect talk on orphan and vulnerable children to start. So which side of the banana do you open it with? When you grab a banana, if you like eat bananas, which side do you open?
The bottom.
Bottom. Why?
Because it's the easiest place.
It's the easiest place. Did you learn that by just doing it and trial and error, or did someone tell you?
Someone told me.
Yeah. Has anybody else opened from the bottom? Same reason?
My mom said that's
how I'm easier. Okay, yeah. Anybody else open from the bottom? And why?
Because it's easy and I
read
the same thing.
Yeah, so someone told you, but just intuitively, you look and you see a handle at the top, right? And you're like, oh, of course that's where you're supposed to open it from. Well, in fact, this is the hardest place on the banana to open it from. It's easier to squeeze the middle and pop it open, but the easiest is just pop in the bottom and then you peel. So, I mean, just here, peel here, 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 like that. Now, this is kind of unfair because these are way overripe. So this just twigs off. Actually, I had to challenge myself to take it off really slowly because they pop off when they're overripe. But that's we're not here to talk about bananas. But the reason I do that is to show us that this is something that we see every day. Intuitively, it looks like one answer to do something is not necessarily the easiest or the best for that matter. Just because monkeys do it, by the way, is not a good enough reason to do something, because they do a lot of other things that I wouldn't recommend doing it that way. However, when it comes to bananas, I think monkeys know bananas pretty darn well. So, and it is way easier. And interestingly, because this is where, and I did a lot of research into it, more than I should have, but the stem, the reason why it's so strong is because this is where the bananas grow from. So they grow out from here, and then this gets stronger and stronger and stronger as it grows, because it needs to stay strong or else it'll fall off and it won't stay together as a bushel, bundle of bananas? I don't know. I didn't study that part. But that's why this part is so strong in any way. But reason I do that is because orphan care is similar to a banana. If there's nothing else you hear, and hopefully you'll hear more than that. But often we think about it in ways that make sense and they're intuitive. So we have a ton of kids around the world that need love. So what's the intuitive answer? Let's get them into a place that we can just feed them, that we can clothe them, that we can give them an education and call it a day, because that's better than what they had. right? It's better than nothing. Something is better than nothing is a great intuitive thing that isn't in Scripture, right? It's not biblical to say something is better than nothing and finish. God does not work in a something in the better than nothing mentality. He works in an excellence mentality. He works in a mentality that is best. He works in mentalities, how can we flourish? How can we bring shalom? How can we make all things new? That's God's heart, right? And so we're going to talk about that over the next couple days. What does that look like in the context of orphan and vulnerable children? What does that look like in the context of the children, the fatherless, the people that don't have advocates for them, the people that are out there, you know, suffering? And how can we come alongside them in ways that really help them? And who's read When Helping Hurts? You've read it. Has anybody else heard of When Helping Hurts? So your number one assignment after, if you're in this room and you haven't read When Helping Hurts, you absolutely need to. Like, I don't care if you never read. Like, read that book. Because if you're in this room, then you're truly trying to help others, right? I mean, hopefully you're doing that anyway as a Christian. But something brought you to this room. And that book talks about, the subtitle is How to Alleviate Poverty Without Hurting Others and Yourself. Talks about so many things. We're not going to talk about all the details of that, but I teach a class on this work, and that book is the first text we have for that class at the university level, because it goes into worldview issues, and worldview is everything when you're doing this work. So that's just kind of the intro stuff. I wanted to start with Providence. If you go to providenceworld.com, that's the website of the organization that I get to lead and I get to be a part of. I'm the president of that organization. I'm also the co-host of the Think Orphan podcast. I do most of the interviews for Think Orphan. It's at thinkorphan.com. Again, if you're in this room, that the sheets I gave you have some episodes in different areas. So what, you know, as I wanted to put together some resources for you there that you can, yeah. And there, if you didn't grab a handout on the way in, they're back there. So I try to do that, but we're going to talk more tomorrow of the specifics. So you can read ahead, and I'm sure some of you are, because I'm that kind of guy. If you read ahead, that's there, but might not all make sense yet. So we're going to talk about the handout more tomorrow than today. Today's more of overarching, you know, today's more the why, and we'll get a little bit into the how, but tomorrow is almost all how, so hopefully you'll be able to come today and tomorrow. If you're here and you're not hiking or like hanging out with the college and young adult kids at the whatever he said they were going to, sounded really fun. They both had Birkenstocks on, so I was like, they're way more fun than this. But that's okay. We still are here and we can hang out and have fun anyway. So this is my family. There it is. Wait, where? I'm going to go back. So beautiful wife Becca on the far left. Oldest is Malia, she's 17 or 16. Drew's 15. Justin in the middle, 7. Kirsten is 9, almost 10. Savannah is 13. I'm there in the maroon. You might see her running around here this week with Amata babysitting. And then that's me on the right. So father of 5, husband of 1. And when you talk about family, that's the other thing here. So we know at some level we're called to love orphan and vulnerable children. At some level, as Christians, we're called to plead the widow's cause and to bring justice to the fatherless. And too often in things, we just kind of wing it. We just do things without really thinking about what it means and why we do things. And I like to bring people's attention to when we really care about stuff. Like, how many here are parents? Okay. How many, if it was by, you know, traditional pregnancy, birth, read the book, What to Expect When You're Expecting? About half, 3/4 maybe, 2/3, whatever. How many bought it and didn't read it? I have 5 kids and I never read it. I asked my wife for the Cliff Notes version of it and she did a good job. We read stuff, we research stuff. You read some sort of articles on how to do stuff better. You go to Pinterest on how to cook that favorite dish better. You go and you research things you care about. You go and you figure out how to do these things better, even if that means talking to somebody else about how you can do things better. You go and you have support groups for whatever. You have your friends, you have other people. You're like, hey, you know, I'm struggling this with my son or my daughter or whatever. How'd you get through this if you know other people that have gone through it? But I fear that in this type of work, when we're doing anything, whether even if it's just a mission trip for a week, we just kind of go into it without really thinking. I talk about that book, When Helping Hurts. That is one of those things that if you're going on a short-term mission trip, it should be absolutely mandatory reading. And no one should be allowed to leave the country. It should be like passport, and have you read When Helping Hurts. I firmly believe that. I said basically anyone that's breathing should read this book. And this seminar is not about When Helping Hurts, but it is about When Helping Hurts. Because When Helping Hurts is a book that talks about how we can do tons of damage if we don't really know what we're doing. And we just go into it without really thinking about how we actually, in our God complex often, as especially Western wealthy people, can go into a different country and think that by giving them stuff, we're actually helping to alleviate their poverty, when in fact, by just giving somebody in material poverty stuff, you're actually exacerbating their poverty. Way too much for today to go into that in depth. But that idea goes into all these other concepts that we're talking about in the care of orphan and vulnerable children. Even your question earlier about the situation at the border now with the separation of families. It's a nuanced situation that has so many different moving parts that to just say we got to get the kids back in family is way too simplistic of a answer to a multi-pronged issue. We're going to talk more about that tomorrow, but that's how most these issues are. International adoption is another one of those. Foster care is another one of those. There are so many moving parts in these issues. And so hopefully what we're going to talk about today is how all these things are interconnected and how we need to see it not in silos, not as, I'm fighting against trafficking, so therefore I'm not really passionate about poverty alleviation or adoption or foster care. In fact, they're all intertwined and they're all the same. They're really part of the same body of work, so to speak. I like to start with my family because also the idea that I really take into every work, everything that I do is, I study my kids regularly. Every day I'm studying my kids on how they tick, how I can love them better. And we need to do the same thing in our ministries with other people. Because if we don't, we might as well not even be doing it, in my opinion, because then we could be doing them a disservice if you're just kind of coming in and out without really pouring into them. Because these kids, more so than my children, need people in their lives because they've never had it where people have loved and stuck around. So that's kind of an overarching as we're talking about these a lot of these different things. I know this is, I commend each and every one of you being in here. Like, honestly, this is family camp. Like, I come week one with my family, and I'm just amazed that this room is this, because it's a heavy topic. This room is this full. It's a heavy topic that's like real stuff, and we're like hanging out at family camp, right? So I'm glad you're here, and if you have any questions about anything, like, let me know, because I get excited when people, some of you, in fact, why don't we now, just how many in here are like work in something related to orphan and vulnerable children, whether it's profession or volunteer work? No one. Used to. Okay. That's fantastic. Like, I'm like even more excited now. How many have adopted? Okay. How many have done foster care or adoption, I guess? Okay. How many are adopted? Okay. Been through the foster system? Okay. I kind of like to know generally who's in the room. But if anybody has things to add, like if you've been adoptive, if you had adoptive, if you've done anything like that, as we talk about poverty alleviation, if you've been doing that, or if you've worked in that, you have something to add. Obviously, let's try to keep it short to respect the fact that there's a lot to cover over the next 2 days. And I can't, this is like a semester's worth of information in 2 days. So I'm not going to obviously cover everything, but I did it for week one, and the one comment I got was it was great, but it was like drinking through a fire hose, and you covered way too much over the 2 days. So I'm going to try to kind of taper back a little bit on the amount of information and try to touch on the things that are, and I cut it down substantially, but at the same time, I don't want to cut short the critical things. So if there's anything that just doesn't make sense and I'm cutting out, please don't hesitate to ask. But also respect, like if I say, hey, can we talk about that afterwards? Like, don't be offended, because it may be that it's tangentially related but not really necessary to talk about before. And if anyone's interested in it, we can talk about it afterwards at lunch, whatever. I'll be here today, tomorrow, through this talk, and then I actually got to head to Honduras tomorrow on a red eye. So we can talk today anytime, really. I'll be the guy in the hammock on the field over there. So, because I don't get very often where I don't have my five kids at Mount Hermon. So it's pretty fantastic, actually. It's kind of weird. I almost don't know what to do. Shoot, this is being recorded. I love you, children. Oh, they're not going to listen. Who are we kidding? My kids aren't going to listen to this talk. Okay, but the other thing about my family that I want to say is, like, that's the benchmark I use. And I hope that as you guys are doing the work with children around the world or in your backyard, wherever it is, that you're using that, like, if something were to happen to my wife and me, how would I want my kids to be loved by whoever's taking care of them? That should be the standard we're using for any child that we are, that brought into our life or that we seek out, right? How can we love them the same way we want to be loved, the same way that we would want to love our children, and we'd want our children to be loved if anything were to happen to us? That standard, it can be nothing less than that, right? There's no second-rate human being. There's no child that God made and said, you know what, this child's not going to be loved at the same level. He has gifts and talents, but we don't need to really develop them because it's just not important with this one because they're on a different class of children. You know, there are some worldviews that believe that. It's not a biblical worldview. And so that's the premise. And if you hear nothing else besides that over the last, in all seriousness, like, it's been worth it. And I think that we've, you know, fortunately we're going to talk about some other stuff too, but that is something that the more I do this, the more excited I get about seeing little kids and older kids and adults, like, realizing that God created them to do something amazing and they're unique and they have amazing gifts and talents. And sometimes nobody's told them that. I have a 38-year-old guy that I've gotten to know pretty well, and he's like, I hate birthdays. I hate Christmas. I hate Easter. Because I've never had anybody to celebrate it with. No one's ever celebrated my birthday, and I'm 38 years old. And it just brings you into a different, you know, mindset when you're thinking through these things. But is it too late? He's like, no. I wish someone would adopt me. He's 38 years old. It's like, man, you just want to think about these things. You're like, no, you're an adult. What are you talking about, be adopted? He's like, I want a family just like everyone else. You know, so these are things that when you open your eyes and when you start seeing these different things, it's like, it's interesting. So it's also interesting that God brought me to this work personally, because most people that come to this work, I don't know, is anyone familiar with Strength Finders test? So a couple things interesting about Strength Finders. Going back to that unique thing, it defines somebody. So Strength Finders has 34 strengths. And if you take the test online right now, you can do it for $12. You get your top five strengths in order 1 to 5. To find somebody else in the world with the same five strengths in that order is 1 in 33 million. Okay, and then if you go 1 to 34, it's infinitesimal. It's you're not going to find anybody else. So the test proves that you're unique, even if you didn't already know that. But then the other thing about that's interesting about the test on a personal level, I took the test. I paid the $75 to get 1 through 34. And empathy for me, who wants to guess what empathy for me is on 1 to 34? I run an orphan care organization, so it's got to be really high. So what do you think it is? What? Close. 33 out of 34. So, like, the opposite of what you'd expect someone who runs an orphan care organization. But doing what I do, God knows what he's doing, because if I had tons of empathy, I wouldn't be able to do what I do. And which is, I think, a good other lesson in, because what I have to do is I have to go in and kind of analyze things at a high level. And I have to be kind of a detached from it. Now, on the flip side of it, my numbers 2 and 3 are relator and communicator. My number 4 is learner. And my number 5 is activator. Arranger is my number 1. But the reason I say all that is you might think to yourself, I'm not a bleeding heart, Phil. Like, I'm just not wired that way. I'm not wired to do this in this way. If, you know, you're here and your husband or your wife is kind of the, like, Phil Dark, like, not really. And focus for me is 31, which is why I do rabbit trails like I already have. So my COO has told me I'm not made to do talks. I'm made to MC conferences. He didn't tell me that. I actually have realized that. He did tell me similar things. But it's something that we're all wired differently, but we're all called to love these children. And we're all called to do it in different ways. So, like, I so often would go on a mission trip and be like, I don't want to work, like, pounding a hammer because I'm not a contract. Like, I don't know how to do these things in a way that's going to be really good work. So why am I doing this? and to find, for God to kind of bring me, but to not say, but I'm not called to serve in any way. But how can I use my skills, how I'm wired, to actually help? And that's what God said, hey, I got this thing for you. But it was open to it. It's open hands, right? So come in with who you are. Don't force a round peg into a square hole. And then God can use you in pretty awesome ways. Because, again, if you'd have told me I was going to be doing this 13, 14 years ago, I would have thought you were nuts. It would have made no sense. And still doesn't make a lot of sense, quite frankly. But it's making more and more sense as I'm doing it. Anyway, if you listen to week one, and we're now 23 minutes in, very different talk. So, that's why you never know. You can go listen to week one and get like total, you can get all kinds of new information. It's going to be great. But I think the rest will be close. So, pursuit of excellence. We talk about excellence in how we can love orphan and vulnerable children. You always start with why. Has anyone heard the TED Talk, Start With Why? Simon Sinek, great TED Talk. If you haven't, check it out. It's like 15 minutes. Start with why. Simon Sinek, start with why. Has nothing to do with orphan care, but it has everything to do with orphan care, because you need to start with why you're doing something. When you talk about doing something, anything, if you don't start with why, you won't know what's driving you to do it. And if you don't know what's driving you to do it, it'll be short-lived. And it also helps you do whatever you're doing better. And it also helps you able to get other people involved with it, because people buy, as he says in his talk, people buy the why, people don't buy the what. And so I'll let you listen to that talk to find out all of that part of it. But we got to start with why, which is basically awareness. It's knowing why you're doing something, helping others know why you do something. And if you want this, my email address is on. I believe my email address is. Did I put it on the handout? Just shoot me an email and say, can I get the slides? I'll shoot you the slides. So I mean, you can take pictures and do all that too. But if you want to do that, you can do that. We can get connected that way too. Next is how. Everything, as we'll talk about, how is the cultivation of the why. So you're cultivating it, and if the how isn't always done with excellence, you're not going to have the transformative what as a resulting excellence. You'll have a what being mediocrity or less. And so we need to make sure the why is solid in our minds, the how is done with excellence, and then the what will result from that, which is a transformation of lives, transformation of hearts in this instance. All right, so why do we do what we do? Why do we do this? Why are you sitting in your chairs here? Well, you have a lot of verses on that handout. Last time I just talked about the verses, and my wife was sitting right there. And she said, don't just tell us, prove it. And she didn't say that during the talk. She said it, and she said, I don't think she said it quite that way either. She's actually very kind and said it in a very loving way. But she said, prove it, like get the verses. So that's why I went and actually wrote that handout in between day one and day two last time. So, and then I modified it this week, and actually you get the new and improved version of it. But I put, those are just 22 of the many more than that. So there are a whole lot more. I just went and found 22 that were pretty solid verses on loving the orphan, loving the vulnerable. But more than that, or as much as that, it's not just God saying you need to go do this. It's God establishing throughout Scripture, my heart cries out for the fatherless, for the widow, for the oppressed, for the sick, for the poor. I'm the defender of the fatherless. I'm the defender of the widow. I'm the defender of the oppressed. I'm the defender of the poor. I love these kids. I love these people more than you ever will. And you know what? You get to be a part of it with me. Not you have to. I love what you talk about. It's a duty and an invitation, or a duty and a... We talk about rest today in the talk. I'm forgetting exactly what he said, but it was like duty and an invitation all at the same time. I think if you see it as a duty, you won't do it for that long. Right? If you see it as guilt trip, you won't do it for that long. But if you see it as, you know what? I'm an image bearer. I'm the Imago Dei. I am created in God's image, and God loves these kids more than I ever will. So therefore, I get to do this work with God as an image bearer. My heart should break for what breaks God's heart. And this clearly does. And the Scripture bears it out from start to finish. Right? You know, I talk about James 1:27 and Isaiah. I purposely did one Old Testament, one New Testament. But verses can just be like, okay, whatever. Right? But then you start seeing it throughout, you know, Scripture in real ways, and over and over and over again. It's kind of like that guy that you meet at a meeting that lives in your hometown, and then you see him everywhere, right? For the next like year and a half, he's like at the store. He's like, you like think he's stalking. Turns out you probably have seen him everywhere before that too, but you just met him, right? And what I say to people a lot of times is, now you've met orphan care. Meet orphan care. Meet what God really means by orphan care. Now you'll see it everywhere. Okay? And then the get to versus have to, right? So how many times when someone says, hey, you have to go take out the trash, you have to go do the dishes, you have to go do something, do you do it joyfully and go, yes, thank you? Very, very, very rare. Go back to that picture of my family in your mind. I'm not going to actually go back there. My kids, when I say, hey, do the dishes, or please do the dishes, or hey, can you do the dishes, I don't usually get a great response. I often refer to dishes as the kryptonite of families. If it weren't for dishes and bedtime, I'm convinced every family would have no problems, and maybe folding clothes, depending on the family. But, and if, like my daughter, for instance, you know, my oldest daughter, if I ask her, hey, can you do the dishes? But I just did the dishes 4 times this week, which isn't true, ever. But Savannah hasn't done the dishes, but Drew hasn't done, you know, I mean, if you have multiple children and they're old enough to do dishes, you, I'm assuming, know this drill. Well, one time, my oldest, now 16, she was probably 12 or 13 at the time, babysitting, one of the first times. By the way, the law in California, if you live in California, is 10 years old, you can leave your children legally with the oldest sibling if they're 10. So that's a good thing to remember. It was a game changer in our house. Not necessarily appropriate, but we tested it out immediately at 10 years old and went to Starbucks for a couple hours. It was great. But everyone's still alive, so it was a successful experiment. We went on a date. Came home and she meets us at the door, and I'll never forget it. I could picture it like it was yesterday. She meets us at the door. She's just beaming. She's smiling. Remember, this is a girl who doesn't ever want to do dishes, and it's always everybody else's turn. And she's smiling. She's like, hey guys, hey mom and dad. And I look at Becca and I'm like, okay, what's going on? I'm like, hey, what's up, Malia? Like, what's going on? She goes, Gah. And we kind of come around the corner to our kitchen, and it was like spotless. I mean, and it was a mess when we left. And it was like, you know, those like movies where the stars are coming off the counter. I mean, it was like sparkling, that like Bounty commercial. It was perfect. It was spot. It was the best job I've ever seen in the kitchen done. And she was joyful. Like she just had joy beaming out of her. And I use this example to show like, this is what it's like when you get to do something versus have to do something. When she had to do it, it was a mediocre job at best. She knew how to do everything, obviously, because she did it here. She still knows how, and still to this day, she hasn't had another time like that. The difference, simply, she got to do it in one. She's choosing to do it because she loves her mom and dad, even though she wouldn't admit it at that time. She wanted to do something to bring joy to us because she knows that would show love to us. And it's the same thing with God, right? Like, when we get to do something with God, I think our job will be so much better, and it will last way longer, right? We're not going to do it out of duty for that long. C.S. Lewis has a great quote. Duty is a substitute for love. It's a crutch. No one would ever use a crutch if they can walk. In the same way, no one would ever use duty if they actually have the love. And I think it's a beautiful thing. Sometimes we need duty, though. Sometimes we need duty to get us going. So it doesn't mean you can ignore it if you don't have the love, if you don't have the, you know, desire to do something. If it is out of guilt, sometimes God will use that guilt to get you going on the right path. And then hopefully it will be that crutch until you can actually heal your heart and your heart can soften to make it love so that you can actually do it for much longer. Because burnout will happen. It happens all the time to people when they're doing it out of duty. And no kid in the world wants you to come in and do it out of duty over and over and over again. That will shine through. If every day I wake up in the morning and go, well, I gotta love my kids. I have to take my kids to wherever. I have to get my kids here. Okay. If I don't love my children, it's not gonna be a good job as a parent. So that is that get to versus have to mentality, right? Like, we get to do things. Even with our kid, my kids, I train them, like, when you're sharing, I was so proud of my daughter yesterday at church. She was coming to Amada to do this, and they had her share at church to pray over her, and she said, I get to go and learn how to babysit. I get to do a devotional for 2 weeks on the fact that I'm God's beloved. I get to. And a couple people came up to her afterwards and said, I'm so glad you said I get to. Because it's just a mentality, right? If we understand, and actually the more we voice it and the more we think about it, the more it becomes intentional, the better it will be, right? Does that make sense? All right, so again, the why too. So let's know that. God's heart breaks for these kids. It's God's heart to protect the orphan and the vulnerable. It's God's heart for us to join with him in this work, right? We get to do this stuff with him. But right now, there's over 150 orphan and vulnerable children. Now, I want to be clear on what I mean by that, because you hear stats all the time. There's 153 million. I think UNICEF's latest number is somewhere between 140 and 160 orphans in the world, is what UNICEF will say. Problem with that definition is most people, when they hear the word orphan, think of you don't have a mother or a father. You're completely parentless. With that UNICEF definition, it's you are either you don't have a mother and a father, and you're a double orphan, or you're missing a mother or a father, so single orphans. There's about 12 to 18 million double orphans in the world, and unfortunately, these stats aren't great because there's a lot of countries that don't count children very well, particularly those who are orphaned. They're, you know, in India, they're the untouchables, and there's a whole lot of people in India, so they're not, the counting is less than reliable. But the reason why I say orphan and vulnerable children, because even those stats from UNICEF don't count kids in orphanages. They don't count street kids. They don't count a lot of kids that would fall into that category, clearly. So it's a whole lot of kids, right? That's how kind of I describe it. Tens of millions, a massive amount. And then you hear people saying, well, yeah, but most of the kids in orphanages, 80% to 90% of children in orphanages around the world have living family members. And so they say, so we don't need orphanages. And I say, well, hold the phone here, because you actually have 10 to 20% of children who don't have living family members. So at this point, we need, again, that nuance that we're talking about. When you're talking about massive numbers and you have 10 to 20%, you don't have to be a mathematician to realize that's a really big number. And as I say, if there's 10 kids that need families, we need to do it with excellence. We need to do it really well, and there's a whole lot more than 10. So that's why, right? And then the numbers aren't going down right now. They're going up. So what does that tell us? It tells us that the current approach is not working. And I believe a big part of that is we are, a lot of it's that we're trying to do it in silos, and we're addressing symptoms rather than root causes and foundational issues. So we need both. Have you guys heard the analogy in the river where the kids are floating down the river and people are grabbing them and just going in and, you know, saving them and rescuing them out of the river before, judging from the face of that you haven't heard it. So they're rescuing the kids out of the river before they fall over the waterfall. And people are just going crazy, but there's just too many kids, and some of the kids are falling over the waterfall, and they're not able to save them, and they're rescuing. And then one person says, you know what, why don't we go upriver and figure out why they're falling in the river in the first place? And maybe we can build a fence so they can't get into the river. And that is kind of the prevention side, right? So we need to have the people, yeah, grabbing the kids who are already in the river, getting them out. But if we can prevent them from getting in, we can alleviate the crisis so that we can handle the children that are in the river better. If a kid hops the fence, a whole lot of kids, you know, whatever, to keep the analogy going, right? So that's where we talk about the current approach is not solving the problem. And we see that as we talk about the fatherlessness in the world, or in the country. The stats of fatherlessness are, and we'll see a video tomorrow that will go into the stats a little bit, you know, deeper, but 85% of children, or 85% of youth in prison are fatherless. It's like the depression levels of fatherless children are way higher, chances of fatherless, or chances of depression, suicide, way higher. I mean, the rates of a lot of the social ills, the fatherlessness is showing that the current approach of just kind of putting a Band-Aid on the kids' life, putting them into a motherless or a fatherless home to address fatherlessness, Doesn't work a lot of the time. So you not get a mentor for that child, doesn't work a lot of the times. Now, could it work? Are there examples of children who have succeeded and thrived without, you know, mother or a father? Absolutely. But the odds are, if you don't have a mother or a father figure in your life, it's a much, much more difficult and a huge uphill battle in order to really flourish and hit your, especially when it comes to family, especially when it comes to, you know, the attachment, being able to have a healthy family yourself, the odds of that are really low. And again, at the end of the day, if you don't have a powerful why, you're probably going to burn out. So we got to understand these issues much, much deeper. And again, not, it's already 10 to 12. So it's crazy that we're just getting started, right? And this is, there's so much more to each of these issues. I feel like I'm totally shortcutting every one of these, because I am, because you can only handle so much in 2 days. And I want you to be able to, like, go to lunch and go on the Sequoia Ropes course and not just be, like, bummed the whole time, too. So I want to give you some hope, too, before we get out of here, so I got to talk a little faster. So, you know, this is a picture from an orphanage in Uganda. And most orphanages are institutions like this one, where they're just housing, feeding, clothing children, orphan and vulnerable children. And as I said, most of the children have living family members, about 80 to 90%. So that tells us, if we could strengthen the families, if we could alleviate poverty, if we could, you know, disciple the parents to show them why it's so important for them to be the parents and not just outsource this parenting side of things, that these children, their children will be way better off than if they get a great education and food and clothing and don't have mom and dad in their lives loving them. That's one of the issues, right? So that's one of the realities, right? And then this is, you know, often a picture I use to talk about, often we're hurting more than we're helping when we try to have a solutions that's lesser than. So this is a baby's home in Uganda as well. They're doing a lot of really good stuff, but this is the dining hall, quote unquote. They literally stick the kids in these seats. There are orphanages where there are 12 to 15 kids in cribs throughout, you know, in a room. They have one I never forget in Honduras when I went there. There were 13, 14-year-old special needs kids in cribs in the corner, and they were just sitting there all day, every day, and they don't have no idea what to do with them, and they're not loving them. They're just warehousing them, right? So these are issues. Now, are there good places that actually absolutely love children? Yeah, I mean, La Providencia in Honduras is the orphanage in Honduras. Technically, it's an orphanage, but it's actually family homes, as I often will describe those families, and they are way healthier than most of the families in my hometown in Folsom, California, in my neighborhood. And they're amazing families that love these children extremely well, but technically, it's an orphanage. And so we can be creative in an orphanage setting to actually love the children in families and still be within the law, the legal structure of an orphanage. So we need to be creative. We need to come up with solutions that aren't just the warehouse little orphan Annie sitting in a home that isn't able to attach the kids, isn't able to do a lot of the things that these kids absolutely need. Because, yeah, it feeds them. Yeah, it clothes them. Yeah, it gets the basic needs, but it does not give them the sociological, psychosocial things that they need, the attachment, the love, the confidence, the self-confidence, the identity, discipleship, the community, the, you know, so many of the things that they just need to really be able to flourish. When we think about all the things that we don't even think about having, like community integration, because so many orphanages are isolated in the name of safety, when in fact it's just getting the kids and removing them from sight so that people don't have to think about them. But we need to integrate the kids into communities. So that's kind of the issues that we have. And then the statistics, there's a study in Russia, and it was in the late 90s, but it's still pretty accurate from what I understand as far as the stats. And it basically talked about when kids age out of an orphanage, within 2 years of aging out in this Russian study, over half, 60% of the kids, no, 6,000 of the 15,000 were homeless, 5,000 were unemployed, over half of the girls were forced into trafficking, and 10% of them had committed suicide within 2 years of aging out of the orphanage. And so that's just an example of, like, it's addressing basic needs, but children and everyone needs more than just basic needs to really be able to flourish and be able to see themselves as having a role and a place in society, right? And so, again, the why is, like, why are we even here? Why are we thinking about these things? Well, it's because we need more than just dealing with symptoms. We need a full spectrum solution where we're covering both preventative and restorative measures together. We're not working in silos. We're actually working in team, as a team. There's a great book. It's in your resources called Rooting for Rivals. It literally comes out tomorrow. I say literally. I'm pretty darn sure it comes out tomorrow. Probably should know that. I'm on a launch team. A good friend of mine wrote it. He runs Hope International. His name's Peter Greer. You may know about him. They do microfinance all around the world. Amazing, amazing guy. Great friend of mine. And it's called Rooting for Rivals. It's about collaboration in this space. So how we can actually work with other organizations, how we can work with other people to do this work together, create synergies rather than literally destroying each other with competition. And if we don't work collaboratively, we will destroy each other. And that's exactly what Satan wants. And right now he's winning, quite frankly, because the nonprofit world is a very dog-eat-dog world, because everyone's fighting for dollars and fighting for money, whereas if we saw each other as part of kingdom builders together, and not everyone's supposed to do the same thing, and in fact other people do things better than us, and we actually accept that and believe that and really work that out and live that out. And I'm a lifelong soccer player, and so tomorrow I might be a bit distracted, I'm not going to lie, because the semifinals are on tomorrow. But what you see in soccer and what you see in real team sports is if you try to have some, if you have someone who thinks he or she is better than everyone else on the field and they're trying to take over the game, that team will likely lose. If they're competing against their own teammates for the glory, they will likely lose. At some point, they will very unlikely win championships. The teams that are average, that love each other and work together and care about each other's flourishing and actually root each other on and actually get excited when the other guy scores, even though it wasn't them who gets the glory, those are the teams that win. Those are the teams that love each other. Those are the teams that succeed long term and stay together for long term. So that's something we need to be in this, in the kingdom work. I mean, yeah, orphan care is part of that, and orphan and vulnerable child care is part of that. But really, the care of orphan and vulnerable children literally covers every part of ministry that you're gonna talk about. If you're talking about youth ministry, if you're talking about family ministry, if you're talking about men's ministry, women's ministry, whatever, there's implications. The orphan child and vulnerable child touches those and is touched by those ministries. So we need to be thinking about it more holistically rather than as a side ministry that is the person who's adopted starts the orphan ministry and they talk about it on Orphan Sunday once a year and now we can check the box and we can say we visited the orphan and the widow and their affliction. It needs to be more than that. So it needs to be these things together. So the prevention I've talked about, it's these things. It's family strengthening. It's poverty alleviation. It's church planting. A lot of people are like, church planting? What are you talking about church planting? Well, the church planting, most churches around the world, especially if you're in a developing world country and you're planting a church, most of your congregation will be orphan and vulnerable children for the simple reason that parents want a break. So they send these kids to church on Sunday. So I've known churches, 90, 95% when they're planted are children under the age of 15 who are from broken homes or have no homes because they're going to find love. So if we don't know how to address those needs and those issues, we're going to fail every time. We're going to go in preaching some sermon about, you know, Zechariah 4. I don't even know if there's four chapters in Zechariah, but probably should, huh? We can look it up. No, but if we're just preaching on these things and these kids are like, I just want someone to call me son. I just want a family. I just want someone who cares about me. I just want someone who loves me. Like, and we don't even know how to do that, how to enter into that. What are we doing, right? Now, I'm not saying we don't preach the gospel. We need to preach the gospel. We need to preach it hard, and we need to stay firm on our doctrine. We need to have our convictions. We need to stay rooted in the gospel. But we need to understand what these children really need and not just feed them and send them on their way, but to really dive into their lives. And if we're not willing to do that, then we can't be starting to these things. We're not doing it to chalk up a chart to say on, you know, Christmas Day that we helped start 48 churches around the world and we have no idea what's going on over there, and we really don't know how we're serving the community, but we've done it, so that's where our money's. We got to do more than that, or else we're going to be having this conversation in 20 years, and these numbers are going to be 250 to 300 million. Discipleship. I'm going to go back to family strengthening real quick. So family strengthening is something that is, first of all, what time, does anybody have kids in kids camp? 12:15, you pick them up. Okay. I'll try to finish by 12:10 so that we could have some questions or whatever, and then you can, the little secret, I'm being recorded, but that's okay because they know it. You can be a little late. So, but I will respect it. Don't push it like we have in the past. But family strengthening is crucial. I usually start my talks when I go to speak at any church around the world, because most congregations that I'm speaking to are likely, and I say this because I believe that a lot of people aren't called to adopt or foster. I think you're called to get involved in other ways. But what I say to most people is, like most of you, second what I said today, is most people are going to go, that's not for me, that's not my passion. Fact of the matter is, orphan prevention starts in our homes with our biological children, loving them well so that they aren't orphaned, so that they don't create orphans in the future, so that we can keep our family together and not create fatherless children by, you know, whether it's through divorce or through leaving or through whatever, whether, you know, we're going to raise up boys that turn into men that actually love their wife and stay with their wife and love their kids and father them and do, and then that will then cause more and more. And not only, and when you strengthen your family, you're a model for others' families to strengthen them. And you can speak truth into other families so that they can stay together and be stronger, so that you can go over to different countries and help strengthen them. And you can help be a model for them. But if we aren't modeling it ourselves and we aren't living it out, our witness will be terrible and no one's gonna believe us. They're gonna be like, yeah, I've seen your family. I've seen you, you know, you're terrible. Why would I want that? Like, that's awful. You don't wanna be that guy or that girl, right? So it starts in our home, and we can model for others. And then that will help alleviate the orphan crisis, because we will be able to keep families together. And that's the ideal, right? That's the ideal. We don't want, you know, I just always talk to people like, we don't want a ton of adoptions in foster, because that means there's brokenness. Now, we want it for the kids who need it, but we don't want it just because there's kids who are having broken families over and over and over again. We don't want that. That's terrible. So, yeah, we need to fix the foster system where it's broken. We need to help adoptions be safer and better. We need to help it so the disruption rate of adoptions is not 25%, meaning the children go back into the system after an adoption. It's crazy stats if you really look at these things, because we live in a broken world, right? How can we help repair the brokenness at the foundation, at the root, right? Discipleship, the other thing I teach in my class, over and over and over, if there's one thing they learn in that semester, it's if we could disciple men and women, or males and females to be men and women, godly men and women, we would alleviate most of the orphan crisis in our world. We would alleviate human trafficking. We would alleviate the need for mentors. We'd alleviate the need for adoptions and foster care and orphanages. Because if men or males, who knows Matt Chandler? Has anyone heard Matt Chandler preach? So he talks about, we don't need, and he says it in a way that only Matt Chandler can. He's very passionate, and I'm pretty passionate, but he just gets into it. And he's just like, we don't need more boys in this world. We need men. And it's so true. And I always supposed to say, we need to disciple males to be men. And we'll talk more tomorrow about the specifics of that. But the short of it is, like, if we disciple males to be men, we'll have better fathers, we'll have better husbands. We also won't have guys pimping out girls. We won't have guys being Johns for these little girls. We won't have dads telling their girl that she has to go sell herself at a brothel because he bought a TV and needs money. These things happen every day in our world, and it's because males don't have a godly Christian worldview of what it is to be a man. We need to teach our boys that, and we need to teach our girls who they are so that they don't go sell themselves at the brothel when their dad tells them they need to go do that. They know that they are created for something much greater and better. They know that there is something much more than selling themselves to get worth for doing things that they know they shouldn't be doing in their heart of hearts. Some people say, well, some girls choose trafficking or choose the prostitution. No girl chooses prostitution. Something happened in her life that she felt that was the only choice she had. Or some brokenness happened so that she was addicted to sex, or something happened that was not right, right? So we need to disciple, and that's the prevention side. This is the side that if we hit this out of the park, the orphan crisis is, most of it is alleviated. Then we can really focus on the smaller numbers and do that super well, right? So then that goes to the, if they are orphaned, kind of have the cultivation of the orphan care part. So this is like the orphan care, the first for orphan prevention, right? So these are actually caring for orphan and vulnerable children. So foster care, family reunification, we'll talk some specific stuff tomorrow, adoption, kinship care, basically, grandparents, aunts, uncles, whatever, kin, taking care of the kids, how we can help that. Orphan care communities, that's what In Pursuit of Orphan Excellence is about. I tried to coin a term, it didn't really work, happens. For the community like La Providencia, where it's not really an orphanage, when you think of orphanage, you think of something that's typically institution. So I tried to create this, if it's a family setting, in the quote orphanage context, orphan care community. So start saying it, maybe we can coin it, maybe we can work, and all of a sudden it'll take off around the world because we talked about it here. That's what that is, institutional orphanages. There's a place for all of these things in certain situations. And so you'll hear a big charge for shutting down orphanages around the world, things like that, deinstitutionalization. If you talk to anybody, even the most hardcore, and I know this because I've interviewed them for the podcast, the most hardcore anti-institution people, they will tell you there is a place for them in the world today in a certain way to do them well. But, and this is where I will go to the mat on this, we have to do it with excellence. We have to love those kids as best as we possibly can in that setting. It's never okay to just put a kid into a place because it's better than nothing and say that that's good enough. We always have to be striving for excellence, which is what we talk about in the book. Goes obviously way more into depth than I can. I said I can pump this book all day long, and the reason I can is because there's 14 other authors on it who are amazing. Amazing people who are doing this work around the world. I had two requirements for every one of those co-authors. One is they have experiential expertise in this area. So these are the nine prongs: family, community integration, education, nutrition, medical, dental care. I'm reading it because the people on the audio can't read this slide. Medical, dental care, psychosocial care, self-sustainability, national leadership, and spiritual formation. Each of these areas, I got someone from around the world who had experiential expertise in it, meaning they were doing it, and not just talking about doing it. They weren't just studying it, researching it in an ivory tower. They were actually on the ground doing this work. And they have a posture of humility, meaning they're still learning. They don't think they know everything. They don't think they have the answer. This is not a how-to book. This is a discussion. This is framing a conversation, because so many people are saying we just shut these things down, or we love them and they're perfect just the way they are. Neither of those is right. It's somewhere in the middle. And so how can we converse about it? How can we actually have a place that we can go and read this book and say, okay, now when people come to me and they're like, orphanages are terrible, we need to shut them all down. I say, you know what, can you read this book and then let's talk? Because I think that we probably agree a whole lot more than you think we agree, but you're using different terminology. You're saying orphanage and you're thinking of the 150 kid institution when it can be done differently. Because if you go talk in even the Christian Alliance for Orphans Summit, which I go to every year, and some of my best friends in the world are part of it. But if I go there and talk, say residential care, say orphanage, or say family-based care, say these things, if I'm in a room of 50 people, there's probably 50 or close to 50 different understandings of what each of those words mean. Because orphanage means from 150 kids to the family-based home, like family home. That is a mom and a dad who are a Christian married couple who take in six kids into their home and love them forever, even though they're not technically legally adopted. They're spiritually adopted, as we talk about. That's still an orphanage in the same sentence, in the same word. That's what all that means. And so that's a problem, right? So that's what that book kind of addresses. And then we'll talk about this, and then we'll pick up tomorrow. I'm going to say, for the record, I'm really proud of myself. I made it through all this in an hour. That's pretty impressive. Like, that's, if you know me, you'd be celebrating with me. Orphan restoration. So this is if the children aren't loved well early, if we don't adopt, if they aren't able to be adopted and loved in a family, if they're not able to be in a healthy foster situation, if they're not able to be in a family home, in an orphanage, if they're not able to get the things they need, then they need the restoration, right? This is often called intervention. This is often called rehabilitation. I like the word restoration because I think they're restoring to what God created them to be and to flourish, right? Some of my biological children probably need some of this from other people, right? So what is missing and how can we help supplement that? So if it's a kid that didn't have a dad growing up, how can we bring a mentor in as a father? Now, here's something I want you to hear, because it's a struggle and a challenge that I don't know the answer to yet, and I'm still working through it, trying to figure it out. But we have so many little girls who don't have daddies. And every little girl needs a daddy. to say you're beautiful, you're loved, I love you, I'm proud of you. Every little girl needs that. And I have three little girls, and my 16-year-old's still a little girl, right? She needs that every day. My wife is 43. She needs her daddy to tell her that now. But to have an adult male mentor a little girl who needs that, to have that be healthy is ridiculously hard. Even if the male is insanely healthy, that little girl is going to be confused because she's looking to replace daddy, right? And so whether it's romantic, whether it's whatever, it's a really hard, dangerous situation. So I'm sure you understand the quandary and the issue we see ourselves in. To be a male relationship or female relationship, those are great mentoring. That's much easier. But the cross, either way, as a older female to a male, that's even easier. But the something about that, and we see it all the time, right? The 23-year-old girl marrying the 55-year-old dude, and you go into it and realize, not that that can't be right, but you know, so many of the times that happens, the little girl has no dad, or the dad's relationship is terrible, and they just hate each other. Or the girl hates her dad, whatever. So those are the mentoring questions. Tomorrow we'll talk more about specifics. Aftercare for the traffic girls, massive issue. These are things that, all of these things we need to work together and see how family strengthening relates to the aftercare of children. If we can do this, then this is lesser need. But also when we look at mentoring, don't see it as fixing a kid. See it as preemptive family strengthening. Right? So you are actually preparing this child, this girl, this boy to be a father, a husband, a wife, a mother later on in life. And there's so much more to it. It's so much richer than just, you're broken, I'm going to come in and fix the situation. Because that, first of all, puts you into a savior role too, which you're not. Goes back to when helping hurts. Talks about that all the time. The other thing about mentoring, real quick, to make sure I say it so I don't forget it tomorrow. If you start mentoring, only do it if you can keep doing it for the life of that kid. And I don't say that you can still move, things like that. We have technology that you can stay in touch. And promise that kid something and stick to your promise. If you come into the kid's life and say, hey, I'm gonna come in for a year for a specific thing, that's different. But if you're coming in and saying, I'm gonna mentor you, I'm gonna be here for you, don't bail. It's the worst thing you could do is do a super good job mentoring for a year and then leaving. Because that kid will then be proving to himself or herself that everyone that I love leaves me. So don't do that. There's so many different, mentoring is kind of the cheek hip thing to do now. It's not a hip thing to do. It's something that's really hard. It takes a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of effort. And only do it if you can really commit. So, let's end on that, and if there's any questions, I can stick around. If you gotta go get kids, go do that. I don't wanna get in trouble. I was kidding when I said you can be a little late. They're great down there. They love the kids. So, go get them, and then we'll pick up where we left off tomorrow. We'll get more in depth on the specifics of the how and the what and all that stuff. Okay? If you wanna stick around, we can have some questions too.